The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. A long-awaited program today, stemming from something our guest said back in December when Michael was on the show. More about that in just a couple of minutes. We're doing a full-length Space Show program today, but still, pay attention to the clock if you want to get a call into Michael Listener or an email. Make sure you do it while we're still broadcasting. And we would appreciate that. And we have a full regular week of programming coming up. We have on Tuesday, Bob Zubrin is returning, not for Hotel Mars this time, but for a full Space Show program of 90 minutes. And he's been publishing quite a few things, and he just met with Elon Musk down at Boca Chica. And he'll have a lot to tell us, so hopefully you'll listen to Dr. Zubrin when he is on Tuesday evening. Not sure of who the Hotel Mars guest is, but we will have one this week. General Quast is back with us. He's retired Lieutenant General from the Air Force to update us on the Space Force, give us a little information about China and space, and we are looking forward to that. And Rand Simberg will be back as our guest on Sunday on the Space Show. So it is a very, very full week. And again, today, a regular length Space Show program. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And no call screeners. Let the phone ring. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And we are a talk show, so clearly we prefer talking. So that is the primary way for you to reach us. And again, we want your phone calls. 1-866-687-7223. If you want to use email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can post comments on our blog for this show, which is our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. Click on that one. That's also our blog page. And if you scroll down, you'll see comments and questions down at the bottom. And as soon as you post your comment or question, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on the air. But again, we do prefer phone calls, 1-866-687-7223, and the line is available now and will be, so we're looking forward to hearing from you. The Space Show newsletter for the week is already uploaded to our website, so you will see all the programs that I just mentioned, and if you scroll down, you'll see all of the programs we have planned, and we're now actively booking into second quarter. In fact, we're going a little beyond second quarter to right after the July 4th holiday weekend. And believe it or not, we already have a July 7th program scheduled. So you'll see all of that on the website newsletter. Just scroll down until you come to the part where we have future shows planned. Your guest suggestions are certainly welcome. And if you have people that you would like to have on the show for whatever their accomplishments are, please send me that information. I follow up on every single one of them. our email newsletter will go out tomorrow at 6 a.m. If you want to make sure that you're on it, email me your email address, and I will add you to our list. Remember, everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or quickly download programs. There is a Space Show store if you're interested for our logo wear. And to get to our store and see all of what we offer, just click on any of the website pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she will take you to our Cafe Press Space Show store. Your feedback on our store is always welcome. Upper left is an important menu. So a couple of things are there. So one of them is listen live. So this tells you how to listen to a live broadcast like we're doing right now, how to listen to archives off of our website, which are compressed MP3s, and how to listen to podcasts. We are in almost all of the common podcast players for both Android and Apple products. If you have a program you'd like us to be available to for our podcast, email me that information and I will follow it up. If you have any questions or comments, also email me. And if you need some troubleshooting help, I'm glad to help you, but no guarantees of success because I'm not the most technical person around that should be helping people troubleshoot. But just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com and we'll do our best to respond to your questions and problems and needs. And then also remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. That is our parent. And we're listener supported, which means those of you who donate to us are supporting the Space Show for all of us and everyone else. And we certainly appreciate your financial support. As a 501c3 nonprofit, you get a federal tax deduction for your gift if you're a federal taxpayer. The same is true if you pay California taxes. So if you have any questions, email me about that. But also, our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it all out there as well. If you have any questions, again, contact me. If you're interested in the Space Show Advisory Board, which is listed there on the left, but it's also on our homepage now up at the top, contact me again about that as well. And so you can donate via PayPal. Remember, there is a big PayPal button at the top of each of our website pages, and we thank you for doing it that way. If you want to use a check, it is made out to One Giant Leap Foundation, and you mail it to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. All of that information is on our website. And again, questions for anything, just email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We also have sponsors, and like I've been doing with recent shows, when we come to a break between the first and second segments, I will read our short sponsor messages. But remember, sponsors do get the banner ad going across our homepage, which they can change as often as they like. On shorter format shows, I give a shout out to our sponsors. And on the longer programs like today, I read a sponsor message to each of you. And I will do that again during our break. If you are interested in being a sponsor, we still have a few places left for 2020. Email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, your message and your banner ad appear on all archive programs every time someone goes to our website, as long as the Space Show stays active and our programs are archived. And since all of our programs going back to 2001 are archived, and we've been doing sponsorships since 2016, those 2016 banner ads and sponsor messages still show all the time. So it's a lot of ongoing coverage for your brand and your messages. If you're interested, reach me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So Michael Listener is back with us. He is a space attorney, our go-to person for space law and policy. He is founder and principal of Space Law and Policy Solutions, which is a think tank and consultation firm, and he concentrates on legal and policy matters relating to both outer space security, the industry, and development. He has a BS in computer information systems from Franklin Pierce University. He has a JD from Regent University School of Law. He's a member of the New Hampshire Bar, and he publishes an outstanding newsletter, which you should be subscribing to, and you can see it on his website, The Press Seeds. And we'll talk about that during the show because it really is unprecedented and exceptional. When Michael was with us in December, he mentioned war as a tool of law, and that phrase kind of got to me, so I asked him to clarify. And when he clarified, I asked him to talk about it on a Space Show program. So today is that program. He has given us really good, I sound like Ed Sullivan a little bit, for those of you who know who he was, a really, really good PowerPoint that is already on our website that you can download and follow and open even as while we're doing the show, or if you're listening on archives, you can do it that way. It's Lawfare, the concept and its application to the outer space domain. You'll see it uploaded to our blog page for this program, our archive and blog page for this program. Michael, welcome back to the program. How are you today?
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me. It's a nice winter day up here in New Hampshire.
Is it snowing?
No, it's not, but there is snow on the ground, and we're probably going to get a little bit more tomorrow. But it is the season for snow. Spring's on the way, though.
If you get some snow later today, don't forget to look at the moon late tonight. If you're up around, I think it's 1:30 Eastern time, which is the clearest of the snow moon. So for listeners, if you don't know what a snow moon is, Google it. But if you have snow on the ground, it would be really cool to look at the snow moon. I won't have snow on the moon. I won't have snow on the ground out here, but I will be out. It's only going to be 11:30 my time. So something for everybody to do. That's your homework. Go check out the snow moon tonight in your area. It's supposed to be very, very clear, huge, and unbelievable. War as a legal tool. And first of all, tell us a little bit about your PowerPoint so that they'll know what to expect when opening it, what it is not.
Well, when you asked me to do this, I was like, oh boy, okay, this is, and I said yes. So after I said yes, I was like, okay, what the hell did I get myself into? Because this, you know, this whole topic of Lawfare is very expansive, and I really wanted to boil it down for your listeners to really, you know, clear it down to its essence of what it is. So this past week, I thought, first of all, you know, I'm just going to wing it and go do the show and wing it, but you know what? Your time is valuable, and you've had the courtesy of having me on these shows. I was going to go the extra mile and make sure this one was El Primo. So I sat down this past week and actually sat down and did this PowerPoint presentation that basically boils down Lawfare and how Lawfare actually applies to outer space. And I did that for two reasons. Like I said, I want your listeners to be able to, you know, have a good clarification of what it is. But two, I wanted to do it so that I could, you know, kind of distill it in my own mind to actually do this show. So I'm not going to go, this isn't going to be a slide-by-slide presentation. I'm going to use it as a guide as we go through the discussion. And listeners, if you want to call in and challenge me, please do, because this is a very controversial topic. And I made more than a few people angry about this when I brought it up. And if you want to challenge me or question me, you know, call me or email, or I welcome the opportunity. I always welcome good, peaceful, concise, intellectual conversation. Ad hominem, not too crazy about, but I do like the conversation and debate. I respect your views. Let's put it that way.
The term Lawfare, what does that actually refer to?
Well, we got to start back a little, you know, we got to start back a little bit, and actually in September 11, 2001, I'd graduated law school a few months earlier. I was waiting for the bar results, and I was in a law office in Portsmouth, Virginia, and we were watching the Twin Towers go down, and one of the things people were, you know, we were talking back and forth, one of the attorneys was in the National Guard, and he's like, oh yeah, there's going to be a big military response after this, I'm sure. And then I just made a joke. I says, you know what they should really be worried about are the lawyers. And my boss kind of chuckled. He said, that's pretty funny. And I thought, you know, I thought it was kind of being sarcastic, probably a little off color considering what happened. But what I didn't realize is I stumbled onto something that actually exists in the real world. And what it is actually utilizing the law in terms of whether it's treaties or domestic laws or customary law or norms. And we'll go into this more depth as we go into the discussion, but actually using them as an implement to stop an adversary from doing something that would otherwise, you know, they would have to employ armies or navies or air forces or whatever. So and we'll go into a definition of Lawfare, one, the actual definition, and basically my definition, the one that I've been distilling over the past few months. But really, to really understand it, we got to go back hundreds and hundreds of years, and I'm going to do some my presentation has some foundational work here to kind of get everybody on the same page to understand the concept of Lawfare. And then, of course, we'll go in and how does this apply to outer space. Sound good?
Go for it.
All right. I'm going to refer to the slides. And on slide number 3, you'll see I have two views of the world and the law. And there's these two fellows by the name of John Locke, and the other is Thomas Hobbes. John Locke, they were alive pretty much around the same time. But John Locke was this type of guy, what I call a rule of law guy. In other words, when in international law, nations or states, as I'll call them, basically interact via the rule of law, and it's kind of a civilized give and take using the rule of law in order to interact. In other words, we're following the rule of law, we're following international law, or what we call international law is based on what we call natural law. I'm not going to go into discussion of that because that takes hours and hours and hours, and you can look it up, Google it, natural law, and you'll get an idea what I mean by natural law. This other gentleman by the name of Thomas Hobbes basically says, you know what, the rules don't apply in international relations. It's basically the law of the jungle. You do what it takes to get the job done. The rules are there, but basically there are no rules. And if you want to distill it down to a finite thing. And basically it's a matter of one nation taking advantage of another or using hard military power to influence international relations and other states. And it's these two distinctions where you have a rule of law guy like John Locke and a rule of the jungle law like Thomas Hobbes where you get the distinction of lawfare. So with that foundation in mind, if you go to the next slide, on slide 4, I have what I call the genesis of lawfare. Now understand, this term lawfare is fairly recent. I mean, this was coined, well, it wasn't coined for hundreds and hundreds of years until about like the 21st century. But there was this gentleman by the name of Hugo Grotius, and I'm probably going to mangle his name because depending on what language you're speaking, it's defined differently. But this was in 1609, and basically at that time was what we call the Age of Discovery. International law was more based on what we call the papal rules. In other words, the Catholic Church had a lot of influence, and basically what they said went. They were kind of, they basically said what the law was. And during this Age of Discovery, basically the idea was if you discover a new land, you lay down the flag for, king and country, and you claim it. We call it the Discovery Rule. Well, as it was, Spain and Portugal, actually Portugal, in fact, had found a trade route to the much vaunted East Indies, where there was spice and silk, and it was a really valuable trade route for them. And basically, what they were trying to do was they were trying to say, "This is ours." Portugal was saying, "On these oceans, these trade routes that we found, these are Portugal's and Spain." And the Pope and the Catholic Church kind of backed them on that via the Discovery Rule. Now here you have the Netherlands, who they want to get in on the trade too, and what they would like to use these trade routes, but the way Portugal is putting it is, you know what, we own these trade routes. Even though they're on the open seas, we own them. Now at this time there are other, claims from the various monarchies, for fishing rights and such as that, but this is a real biggie because without those trade routes, the Netherlands would have been pretty much cut out of any trade to the East Indies. So here comes Croesus, and he basically comes up with this legal argument called Mare Liberum, which means free seas. And he went up and he got a bunch of the other states together. And again, when I refer to states throughout this discussion, I'm always talking about nations, not states like the U.S. or states in the EU. But bottom line is, he came up with this argument and he argued a big long dissertation in his book Mare Liberum. And actually, it's a interesting book. I read through it, and it's kind of a heavy read. But what he did, he used what I referred to before was natural law, and basically made the argument that, you know what, the seas belong to everyone. Now, does that sound familiar?
Sounds like Innocent Passage.
Basically, and it basically means open seas, and that's something we basically thrive on today. The oceans are open to everybody, no matter what country they belong to. So bottom line is, Croesus is recognized as being the father of modern international law because he successfully argued that the oceans are free, including those trade routes that Portugal found. Now, he was very complimentary of Portugal, the time and resources that they put in actually discovering this route to the East Indies, but he said that didn't give them the right to it, which they were asserting under the Discovery Rule and being supported by the Pope. But basically he was able to argue along with and get other states to support him, saying, you know what, the seas belong to everyone, including these trade routes that Portugal has discovered. And the access of free access of the open seas or free seas was established. So that was highly significant because even today that's something we depend on highly much. In fact, we have, you know, we have navies that go out to actually ensure this quote rule of law. So in other words, I get back to Locke and I'm saying, okay, he established a Lockean rule of law that the oceans are free for everybody. And this concept has been around for 392 years. One other distinction that I placed on Croesus, and people might be a little bit upset about this, he was the father of lawfare. For the first time, a lawyer argued in an international setting that created a rule of law, an unwritten rule of law. It's basically customary in law in most respects that we have open seas, and he did that without the Netherlands having to go to war with Portugal and Spain over it, or without any other conflict. He basically used the law and politics as well to mixed in to establish this. And that's highly significant because back then, you know, Portugal and Spain were very significant powers on the open oceans, and the Netherlands probably wouldn't have been able to overcome them if they tried it militarily. However, they used the law instead to achieve the same result that they would have otherwise tried to, they would have otherwise had to resort to hard military power to achieve. That's kind of the underlying concept of lawfare in a nutshell.
And that's
when it happened 392 years ago.
And that's still is the way it is today, right?
As far as the oceans go, yeah, that's still the way it is. We have free access, and everybody takes it for granted, but don't understand that way back then is when it was actually began. It was actually this thing we now coin as lawfare that actually created that precept. It really didn't dawn on me until I really actually studied. It's like, oh my God, you know, this is something, you know, we never really understood, you know, the effort that went into it and the fact that they didn't have an outright war on the open seas in order to establish those trade routes.
So there are violations of this we read about and hear about all the time by different nations, right?
There are violations, and you know, we have this thing called UNCLOS right now, which is a treaty that codifies freedom of the seas is pretty much codified within that, and there are interpretations of that treaty and such, but still the basic premise of open access to the seas remains, and it has for 392 years.
So now we're talking about the sea. Is this going to be? Is it already? Is it going to have to be a struggle to have this apply to space?
Well, it's actually already applied to space. And actually, you're jumping a little bit ahead. So let me just back up just a little bit. And again, I'm going to refer back to the slide on slide number 8. I basically list what lawfare is. And lawfare is basically using the tools and institutions of law, and international law in particular, to further interests of states and effect change in the international arena that might otherwise require the application of military force. In other words, it's the lawyers doing the fighting and not the soldiers and sailors. We're the ones that go in, you know, the lawyers go in and actually do the fighting using the law or brandishing the law for that matter in some respects to prevent, you know, to get a certain outcome or prevent an outcome for that matter.
But the countries have to be willing to accept the outcome of that skirmish with the lawyers, right?
Basically, I mean, and a lot of that goes back to how much political power that the state actually employing the law has. For example, if the United States, you know, basically went in and had a legal misunderstanding with another nation or with a smaller nation, you know, because of political prestige and such, we might have a little more political power to actually get an outcome that we would like. But a lot of that is you saying, look, this is what the law says. You can't do that. Let me give you a quick example. This is non-space related. There was a situation many years ago where there was a container ship with some cargo on board. Let's just call it illicit cargo, and the U.S. wanted to stop it, but they didn't know how to stop it. I mean, there was a military option, but the problem is you didn't want to use a military option because of the political fallout. Well, how can you stop a ship from sailing? Well, you can see if you can. One way of doing it is looking at insurance. before ships are allowed to sail, they have to have insurance. They have to be have their certificate of insurance that they, before they go out on the open seas. And basically, the government, did some negotiations with the insurance company and got them to pull the insurance certificate. That ship didn't sail and didn't reach its destination. That's lawfare.
Interesting.
Yeah, and basically, it's using the tools of law to fight a battle other than using hard military force. And that's kind of the definition that we'll be coming up to in just a little bit. And this is very, at a local level here as an attorney, I use, when I do litigation stuff, I use a variety of tools. I'm not in court, all the time, battling out face to face. Sometimes I'm using what we call briefs or memorandums. And when I'm writing those, I'm going to the case law and to the statutes, and I'm looking for things that are going to support my position or that's going to undermine my adversary's opinion, position. And I've always looked at litigation and law as basically war in its own sense with different tools. I always say law is by nature an adversarial pursuit. And that gets people upset again because, it's supposed to be creating rules and preventing problems and creating harmony. No, it's about, it's an adversarial relationship or situation where you are trying to prevail for your client's interest. So at a very low, low level, it is kind of, what we do in, the courts here in the U.S. and throughout is basically lawfare. But when I talk about lawfare, it's always at the, it's always at the international level. It's funny because let me give you another example of lawfare, and this is probably a little bit more that back in the Gulf War, we had a problem where the Iraqis were using basically captive American hostages as human shields, and we didn't want to target those areas because of those human shields. Now here was the issue. One, they didn't care what the rules were. There are certain rules of war, that you don't do this. And we knew that, but there were also wars about targeting innocent civilians or in this case, hostages. So basically by using those human shields, one side was ignoring the law, but knowing that the other side would have to abide by the law. So because we had to abide by the rule of because we decided to abide by the rule of law and they decided to break the rule of law, there were certain places we didn't target because of those hostages or those human shields. That's lawfare.
But we could have said, screw you. If this is what you're going to do, our rules of engagement are hands off now. We're just going to go at you, and we don't care about the law either.
Well, see, that's the problem. That's the problem. This is one of the areas where I'm going to sound like, I'm being nationalistic and waving the flag, but the bottom line is, the policy of the U.S. to abide by by the rule of law and preserve the rule of law. So we can't go in there and actually, do that because one, we'd be hitting our own citizens and who are basically innocents and violating human rights, and that would bring a bunch of other lawfare actions, from other groups that, hey, you broke this international law, and they would come at us, which would just invite more lawfare actions on the other side. So a lot of times this is used to it. Let's get right down into the definition on slide 10.
Yeah, because you have an email about that from a listener.
Okay. Just go to slide 10 really quick, and this explains what lawfare is about. And this was in a book that I read on the subject. But the definitive objective of lawfare can be summed up by Sun Tzu in one of his teachings. The supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting. And this gets back to what I said before. But the whole idea of lawfare is to employ the law and political forces to actually go in and gain an objective without having to apply military force. In other words, without having to really fight with a kinetic action. So Sun Tzu really had the whole idea, in essence, it's kind of distilled what the idea of lawfare is. So if you go to slide 11, this is the lawfare defined. He was colonel in 2001, but Colonel Charles Dunlap in 2001 in a paper basically coined the term lawfare and defined it as a method of warfare where law is used as a means of realizing a military objective. That's his definition. Did you want to go to the question?
Yes, it's from Dr. Doug. And he says Wikipedia has a different definition of lawfare than how you are describing it. What is your reaction to the following definition? Lawfare is the misuse of legal systems and principles against an enemy, such as by damaging or delegitimizing them, tying up their time, or winning a public relations victory.
That's Wikipedia's definition. I don't put a lot of stock in Wikipedia because anybody can edit it.
Okay.
And that sounds like a very, you know, and I'll just be blunt. That sounds very politically motivated, and you know, in a sense that it's. I don't think it's the true essence of what lawfare is really about. Let me show you how I define lawfare, and on slide 12. And I've thought about this for a little while. And in fact, when I was making these slides, I actually, you know, tweaked this a little bit to come up with what I have on the slide. To employ the rule of law and its instruments to augment or replace physical force to serve a national interest or achieve a political and geopolitical end. Now, I'm bringing a little. There was this gentleman called Carl von Clausewitz. He's basically any Western military thought is based on his teachings, and some of that definition is kind of actually based on his teachings versus that of Sun Tzu, in the sense that Clausewitz always recognized that a military objective was not an end of itself. A military objective was something you did. A military operation and objective was basically to fulfill a political end. In the end, it's all about, you know, this is going to be, you know, a political end. We're employing this military operation to reach a national, to basically serve our national interest or our political ends. So basically, if you turn it around and look and put law into the equation, it's putting the rule of law or the instruments of law into play to actually reach to achieve a national interest or a political objective. That's different than, you know, with Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu was more or less, you know, once the politicians give you an order, you just do it, and the politicians can't change their mind. You just got to do it. Clausewitz a little bit understood that, you know, political winds change, but in the end, it's about, you know, reaching a political goal versus really reaching a military goal.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting stuff. I mean, and this is something I've been studying like for the past year and a half, and writing about it, and just distilling it. And it really makes sense because, you know, once you start going with that definition, you can see a lot of things happening in the world that ascribe to it. But my big question was, how does this apply to outer space? And that's why we're here today. And after about a half hour, I've actually gotten to the point where we can talk about outer space. A couple years ago, I was having an email, a Twitter battle with somebody from Politico, and, you know, we were having a back and forth, and, you know, they were talking about ASATs and, oh, how there's going to be a war in space. And, you know, my thought was, aren't we already at, how do you define war in space? You know, and when everybody thinks about war, they think about ASATs or some other kinetic form of, you know, of basically, you know, interfering with satellites or assets in orbit. And I'm like, you know, that's nice, but that's a very specific, very focused in one area definition. So I said, what about lawfare? And this is about the time I really started thinking about lawfare and really studying it and formulating my ideas. I looked at that first definition from the Colonel Dunlap. I looked at his definition and said, okay, based on this, how does this relate to space? And I've gone through a bunch of stuff, you know, that I've done before, researched before from, you know, in space. And I said, okay, based on this definition of lawfare that we now have a term for since 2000, now we have a definition for since, and a term since 2001, has this ever happened in the outer space domain, and is it still happening, and it could happen more in the future? And the answer to all three of those is yes, yes, and yes. This has happened before, it is happening now, and it will happen, it will be employed in the future as well. Sound interesting?
Yeah.
Okay. So, where did lawfare happen in outer space? Well, we've talked about, I think a few years ago we had a program on national security. I talked to you about Sputnik and how the Soviets did us a really great favor by launching Sputnik first and going through orbit and establishing free access to outer space. I put to you that was the first act of lawfare in outer space. And here's why. Basically, the Eisenhower administration had the Earth satellite program. They were very interested in launching Earth satellites, you know, for science, among other things. But, of course, they also wanted to use it for photo reconnaissance. At that time, we were using U-2 spy planes to fly over the Soviet Union. Well, yeah, we were flying over the Soviet Union, taking photos, really angering them. And eventually it led to Gary Powers being shot down in 1962 or somewhere around there. But it was towards the end of Eisenhower's administration. And basically idea of photo reconnaissance satellites is, hey, we can fly over these outside their missiles, and we get outside the range of missiles and get all the photos we need, but we don't want to do that and be considered violating their territory. At that point, the Soviet Union had a policy, and it basically, this was the first move of lawfare was on the Soviets' part. They basically asserted pre-Sputnik that we own, our territory extends from the ground all the way up into the space, into outer space above us. So basically they were now what called nationalizing space, and they were saying this is our sovereign territory. A spacecraft or Earth satellite cannot fly through it without violating our territory. Huge conundrum, because the Eisenhower administration wanted to use these satellites for photo reconnaissance and science and other things as well. So what happened was they were kind of dealing with this conundrum: how can we do this, you know, without taking a lot of political flack and taking, you know, and possibly even getting into a war? How can we actually establish this? Well, what happened was on October 4th, 1957, the Soviets did it for us. They launched Sputnik, and it flew all over. It basically flew all over the Earth and over the territory of several states, and they didn't make a peep. And in fact, there was a national security memorandum that I quote on slide 14 that basically says, notice this fact that, you know what, the Sputnik flew over all these practically every nation on the Earth, and nobody protested, including under the Soviet idea of, you know, nationalizing space, they violated their territory. So, given this lack of protest for Sputnik flying over these other places, we feel confident we can step forward and assert that, you know, there is a, quote, free access of outer space. And they did that, and eventually they got that to stick. And the Soviets found out, like, oh, we may have made a mistake. Now, the Soviets tried another lawfare technique, saying, well, you know, the Earth wasn't, Sputnik really wasn't revolving around the Earth. The Earth was revolving under Sputnik. It didn't work. So what happened was we established the free access to outer space using what we call customary international law, which is a tool of lawfare. And we did it without firing a shot, without a big political fracas, and that basically stuck. It stuck. The Soviets just couldn't get out of it. They realized they made a boo-boo, and we were able to start employing photo reconnaissance satellites. So there's another chapter to this. Basically, Soviets realized, oh my God, we've got this problem now. We've actually created this situation where we have a situation where they can fly photo reconnaissance satellites over our territory, and we can't do a thing about it. So during this early 60s, there was what we call the Draft Declarations for Principles on Outer Space, which was actually a precursor to the Outer Space Treaty. And the Soviets tried another lawfare tactic, and basically in this draft declaration, they wanted this statement. And if you look on page on slide 17, it basically, the statement they wanted to put in that final declaration was the use of artificial satellites for the collection of intelligence information from the territory of foreign states is incompatible with the objectives of mankind in its conquest of outer space. In other words, they were trying to mitigate the damage that was created by Sputnik and try and keep photo reconnaissance satellites from being utilized. It didn't work. That lawfare tactic didn't work. So ultimately, the idea of free access and use of what we call remote sensing is now accepted customary international law, and it's been that way since basically just after Sputnik.
So I have two things. One is you got a I think it's a sarcastic email from Adrian. Maybe I'm being too harsh. It's a comment I'll read. You mm-hmm. probably don't need to respond to it. Anyone can edit Wikipedia, but any idiot can ignore it. So I'll just put it out there because he sent the
email.
All right,
that's fine.
If you want to respond, you can. But I think it was the Balboa Declaration with the what was the South American country that was really mm-hmm. PO'd with the satellites flying over in GEO, and they tried to stop it, and they lost.
We're actually going to talk about that, too, believe it or not, because they played lawfare games, too.
And they lost.
And they lost. But the first lawfare action was Sputnik and the free access out of space. And, you know, as I was doing these slides, I was thinking, oh, my God, this is so incredible because this is really analogous to what happened back in 1602 when Grotius basically went before the world at that time and tried and basically made the case for free access to the open seas. In that case, he made an actual legal argument in his thesis, Mare Liberum. But in this case, it was an action by another state that prompted another state to step forward and say, oh, you've established this principle of free access. So you look at it this way. You have the free access of oceans in the oceans by who I consider to be the father of international law and lawfare, and you have the establishment of free access in outer space by the Soviets and their actions with Sputnik 1 and the follow-on actions of the U.S. by asserting it. Pretty interesting, huh?
Yeah.
And I was doing the slides, I was thinking, oh, my God, this is so ironic because we're talking to the two domains that are compared a lot, you know, as far as their similarities. And, I mean, yeah, they are similar, but they do have differences. But still, I mean, I thought that was and I kind of just made that connection when I was actually doing these slides last week for this show. So, hey, I learned something, too, or came to some new conclusions as well on this.
So, and then this, of course, gets put into the Outer Space Treaty.
And yeah, it actually got codified into the Outer Space Treaty. So that basically is, you know, that is the rule of law for over 50 years now, and it's stuck for the most part. I mean, and it's been accepted. Now we're going to talk about some things a little bit later where that's being challenged a bit, but by another state. But yeah, that quote is the rule of law that was actually created by a law by the first lawfare action in outer space.
So I have another email from you.
Sure.
For you. And listeners, I doubt any of you are at work, so how about using the phone? 866-687-7223. So Ben is in Denver, and mm-hmm. he says, how does all this work out with various nations, including the United States, developing ASAT weaponry and capabilities?
Well, we're going to talk about, I think I'll touch on it a little bit because we're going to actually talk about this a little bit later in a sense, but it all goes back to, you know, if the whole idea is, you know, you've got to be careful about what you do in outer space because another nation might say, oh, that's acceptable. And I think a good example is U.S. and Soviets during the Cold War both tested ASAT weaponry, and they both did destructive tests. In 2007, the People's Republic of China came along and popped one of their own satellites with a direct ascent ASAT, and they basically said, you know what, what we did was consistent with international law. And you know what? In a sense, they were right because in my opinion, the U.S. and Soviets performing those ASAT tests without any, you know, blowback, any political blowback from the rest of the world, basically created a customary what we call norm, and we'll talk about norms a little bit later. That, you know, ASAT testing is okay, and even destructive aid test testing. And actually, we'll touch on the destructive aid test ASAT testing a little bit more because the test with India is going to come into play in some of my discussions about NGOs later. But yeah, does that answer your question, Adrian?
No, it wasn't from Adrian. It was Ben in Denver.
I'm sorry, Ben.
So, Ben, if it answers your question, fine. If you have more, either call us.
Yeah, please follow up. Or, you know,
or
better what, give me a call because it's a lot easier to interact with you over the phone than it is via email.
So, where are we today with all of this. So, you know, we say we want space to be available for everybody, and yet, do we really? I mean, I don't know that we really want space to be available for everyone, given the way politicians act.
And I guess this comes back, you know, to basically to, you know, posturing between states, right? Fundamentally, the rule is this, you know, the UN, and again, I'm going to get jumped off for being, you know, you're waving the flag and everything, but basically the U.S. position is, you know, we want to maintain free access for everybody, especially us and our allies. And that's a whole, that's basically the whole idea behind what we call dominance in the outer space domain. And it's why we're having this thing called, we've instituted this thing called the Space Force. The idea of the Space Force is to, not, you know, to basically ensure freedom of access of outer space. Well, look at the, let's go back to the oceans really quick. In the oceans, we have a blue water navy. We have the blue water navy there for two reasons. One, to project force when we need to, and two, but most importantly, to maintain the rule of law, to basically reassert the rule of law of open access that Croesus basically achieved back in 1602 when he successfully argued mare liberum in front of the rest of the old world. So basically what Space Force is the idea is preserving that rule of law while other, to make sure that others don't challenge it or try and deny that type of thing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but again, for it to work, is everybody has to be willing to legally fight rather than to put Starship Troopers up there and fight.
This is a matter of everybody willing to legally fight as a matter of is everybody going to follow the rules? Now, lawfare is a two-edged sword. It can be a great thing for achieving a national interest, but it can, you know, but go back to those two definitions, that my definition and the original definition, and basically it can be used to, you know, basically prevent or inhibit. Go into my case of human shields before, using human shields to prevent targeting otherwise strategic targets or otherwise military significant targets. That's a way of using lawfare to prevent it. Let me illustrate another example of lawfare.
Okay, and now you have a caller waiting. So
sure, let's put the caller on.
Oh, okay.
I think we can...
Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall in little old Renfro.
Okay.
My question is, you seem to be making an extremely large assumption that politicians and lawyers are going to do the right thing. And looking at World War II, Adolf Hitler and Tojo and even Mussolini basically totally misread the whole world economics and basically crashed their nations because they just didn't understand things.
And that's a good point, and that's why we have intelligence agencies. We have, you know, the intelligence community, you know, feeds the information to government. Intelligence communities filter the information and analysis to their respective governments, and from there they make policy decisions, including decisions about, you know, how we're going to present things in the world legal environment. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well,
it isn't always right. It isn't always spot on. I always say, you know, people talk about for space policy in particular. A friend of mine, you know, made a very interesting comment one time. It's like, you know what, this thing, you know, a space policy is great, but it isn't always, you know, it isn't 100%. It isn't 100%, and sometimes it's hit or miss.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm basically saying is, from what I've seen of our politicians in the last year, I'm not too impressed with their capacity to decide things.
Well, and that goes back to domestic politics and internal politics as opposed to geopolitics. How we're going to present ourselves as a nation on the world stage. I mean, bottom line is when it all comes down to it, I'm talking about Thomas Hobbes' view of the world. It's basically, you know, it's the rule of the jungle applies. That this is how the game is played in a sense. And the idea of lawfare is basically the rule, you know, based on Hobbes' assumption that, you know, it is the law of the jungle, and people aren't going to play fair. They're not going to so much follow the rules as use the rules against you.
I think there's an interesting point you're making, and that is, by going out and exercising lawfare and doing it regularly and vigorously, eventually you're probably going to get it right.
Yeah, you know, yeah, and well, the idea is to get it right. Well, you know what, let me go from an attorney's perspective. You know, when I'm working on a case, I'm looking, you know, if I'm basing my argument on a legal theory, and I'm supporting my theory with case law. You know what? I don't always get it. Things don't always work out like I'm gonna like I wanted to. I mean, I was interviewed by Space News a few weeks back about a lawsuit that's going on, and I made a comment to the reporter. I said, look, you know, when I talk to clients about the outcome of a case, I tell them you have a 50-50 chance, and that's being very conservative, that it could go either way. That way I don't raise their expectations, because sometimes you just don't know what's going to happen out there. You know, even the domestic setting. Well, the same thing goes for the international. One thing about war, and I think Churchill said this, and I'm not quoting him verbatim, but basically it says, you know what, when you get into a war, you prepare for the unexpected, because the unexpected is going to happen, and it's not going to go as you planned. So same thing with domestic legals in the court and lawfare in the international arena. You're not always certain what the outcome is going to be, but you've got to proceed. You know, sometimes you got to just take your best shot.
And hope that eventually they get it right.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully you get it right the first time. But you know, and if you make a mistake, hopefully you learn from it. And the next time you try, you get it right.
Well, if you take your best shot and law goes against you, and they say screw you, we're not going to do that, and the next thing you know, the troops are on board. So you've got to have a willingness to abide with a contrary outcome to your national interest.
Well, that's it. You know, you've always got, and that's one of the analysis. What's the downside? You know, what's the downside of it? If I was sitting advising somebody about, you know, this about a lawfare strategy, say, look, you know, this is what we think the outcome could be, but you got to be aware that the downside of this is this could bite us politically, or they could come back and use the same legal tactic on us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to make a point, and that is the open skies thing that Eisenhower put out. Basically, I don't think Russia changed their policy. I think it was Nikita Khrushchev himself decided that putting a satellite in orbit was best for him, and he really didn't care about the Russian point of view.
Well, I think it was more a matter of bolstering, you know, which system was superior, democracy, mm-hmm. republic of U.S., or the communist system of the Soviet Union. And that's basically what, you know, Khrushchev was basically trying to get across. And he was also getting across, oh, by the way, we can also put a nuclear warhead on top of this thing and deliver it. That was kind of a threat, too. But like I said, the Eisenhower administration wanted to get this free access idea implanted into the international legal system because of the Earth satellite program, and the Russians provided the opportunity, and they used lawfare to take advantage of it and cement it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for your call, Marshall.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Listeners, the line is available if you would like to get in on the act and call Michael. 1-866-687-7223. So, Michael, before Marshall's call, you were going to take us off in a little bit of a different direction, right?
Yeah, I was just going to jump back, a little bit of some of the lawfare things. You basically commented on what we call the Bogota Declaration, where there were a bunch of countries. These were the states that basically were aligned along the equator, and they came out and said, this is back in the early 1970s, they think 1976, but basically they came out and said, you know what, we own all the way into space, all the way up to the geosynchronous belt. In other words, you can't put satellites up there without our permission because we own it, which kind of just basically went against the whole free access thing and kind of, you know, got a lot of people angry. And a bunch of states basically banded together and said, no, we're not going to agree to this. And it was basically enough to quash basically what I consider was those countries attempt at lawfare to cement a principle that we own this and you get to get our permission or pay us in order to use it because it's a finite resource and so on and so forth. But that's another little, you know, that little lawfare thing that isn't talked about too much. Very significant, though, because also during that time, as part of the U.S. response, the U.S. basically said that, basically took the opportunity to go back to the Outer Space Treaty and said, oh, by the way, this province of the Outer Space Treaty basically doesn't forbid us from doing commercial activities, which basically laid the foundation for all the commercial activity you're seeing today.
So we
stuck another little lawfare move in there at the same time.
Fascinating. So, yeah. Are there, to the best of your knowledge, are there any real challenges to free access of space right now? Is this a concern? I know there's competition in space, but is there any real challenge by any nation to free access?
Right now, a lot of it goes into space security and the idea of you know, basically ASATs denying the use of space for national security assets or even for economic use. The U.S. economy in particular is hugely dependent on outer space communication satellites, GPS, what have you, and national security. We're very dependent on it as well,
right.
And we rely on that free access in order to. You know, in order to support that. So the idea of ASATs is basically one of those things that that challenges those things. However, there is a line of thought going along in the People's Republic of China among scholars, and this is a little lawfare action that we'll talk about how academics get involved in lawfare as well. Basically, there's been some writings of late in PRC academia saying, you know what, we own the space, we go back to the old Soviet idea. We own the space above us. We own it. It's our territory. And the whole idea is that they're trying to build a legal argument to shoot down foreign satellites that cross over into their territory. It's something that hasn't really stuck yet, but it's something that's kind of creeping. I guess one of the things I could really analogize it with is what's happening in the South China Sea right now. The People's Republic of China basically signed on to this thing called UNCLOS, which is basically the law of the sea. And one of the things that basically says is, you know, it codifies free access, but it also, you know, talks about not making any sovereign claims on islands or atolls or things like that. Well, China basically, you know, over the past, during the last administration, but this isn't me getting political. They basically, you know, just basically moved in and started building these artificial islands. And they just kept on building them. And people were getting kind of concerned about it and now they're starting to make sovereign claims to the ocean. So what they're doing in the South China Sea, they're trying to do right now with space. And this is one of the reasons, you know, I talk about we have to get back to the moon. This is one of the reasons we have to get back to the moon is to prevent something like the South China Sea happening on the moon. In other words, not to make our own claims, but to go back up there and establish and reinforce free access of outer space, including the moon and the celestial bodies.
You have another email question, then
sure.
I'll take a break and do my little sponsorship gig. Helen's in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
And Helen says, I find it interesting, Michael, that you're talking about how governments seem to be relying on the lawyers to work all of this out and to sort of abide by whatever the rule of law interpretation is that wins. However, at the same time, the nations that are spacefaring are creating, building, developing unbelievable weapons to knock the crap out of anyone who tries to physically destroy or alter or impact U.S. space assets, for example. And I'm sure China and Russia are doing the same thing. So while on the one hand they're saying we'll play the law game only so far, and then beware, because we have weapons to take you out, that's their trump card. So it seems like a twofold approach, and law is not the only way that they're thinking of going about this for their
national interest. No, and actually, you know, law, the thing about lawfare is you can use it in conjunction with actual kinetic force as well to basically. Let me try and get. Let me think of an example here where an analogy. if I can basically, if I can, for example, in the domain of space, if I can make an argument that basically the whole idea of nationalization of space is a viable theory, and say the PRC took it, basically said, okay, this, you know, we actually got out there in the international community and asserted this, not just their academics, but their diplomatic arms. They went out and asserted this. And, you know, if during times of hostility, you know, a satellite crossed over into, quote, their national outer space, and it got whacked with an ASAT. If they were being accused of, you broke the rules of law, rules of engagement or the Outer Space Treaty, or that was aggressive action, they were saying, no, they can come back and reassert and defend their act, saying, no, we've asserted this, that this is your law isn't the correct law, our law is the correct law. So it's actually a competition of law, just like a court battle. It's just a matter of, my law doesn't, you say your law applies, but the other side said, no, my law applies. This is why. That's lawfare.
So it's
basically an idea of ultimately, one of the things, lawfare isn't one of those things where you go out, it doesn't go out where you put a bomb on target and say, okay, I want to wipe that place out. The idea is discouraging an adversary from dropping that bomb to begin with.
Well, if you really wanted to say the rule of law will prevail and we're going to abide by outcomes, there would be disarmament. But since we're pretty far away from that, this only goes so far, in my opinion.
Well, actually, disarmament is lawfare too. I mean, for the most part, you talk a lot of those work in the arms control community, and basically they said they'll come around and tell you the arms control agreements are just basically trying to get boxing the other side into a legal agreement which they feel they have to abide to while the other side catches up, and then they basically throw it away. I mean, we've seen this with the medium range treaty that was just the INT treaty, which we just got out of. Basically, there were a lot of allegations that the Russians were basically ignoring it. And the idea, while they were building up their own capabilities, and now we're playing catch up on our end. And of course, China doesn't abide by any of those treaties either, so they're pretty much free to do what they want. That's lawfare.
Listeners and Michael, we're a little beyond halfway, so I'm going to pause us for our break. And I use this time to thank our sponsors and read our sponsor messages. But if you do want to call us, I will continue to answer the phone. 1-866-687-7223, and email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. So we do thank our sponsors. Northrop Grumman is a leading global security company with innovative systems, products, and solutions for both government and commercial worldwide. And their capabilities go from undersea all the way to outer space, and they include cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us as well, and we certainly appreciate their sponsorship. They have their, I believe it's 36th symposium coming up, and it is, as always, in Colorado Springs, March 30th, really just around the corner, April 2nd, Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel. It is a must-attend industry event. The display hall, exhibition hall, is like nothing you've ever seen. Networking is amazing and international. You'll come face to face with some of the people doing the kind of lawyering and lawfare that Michael has been talking about for the past hour. So check it all out, and one-stop shopping for your reservations, spacesymposium.org. Astrox sponsors us. They're our most current sponsor. And they've been involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than 30 years. Their proprietary codes of HiSight and SpaceSight create and analyze such designs. Website astrox.com, A-S-T-R-O-X. And they're in the Beltway in Virginia area, Washington, D.C. area. In addition, AIAA sponsors us. And they are still the largest aerospace professional society. 5 major events, lots of regional conferences, breakfast meetings, lunches, dinners, and other opportunities for great networking. Library of peer-reviewed papers going back decades that you can access. You do not need to be an engineer to be a member. Check it out. Attend the events. AIAA moonword.org is their website. Moonword sponsors us. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon? And they base their decision on technical and economic merit. Moonword is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn to play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com, download an early draft demo of the town, and help fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Celestis is a great sponsor, and they are still the iconic global provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services, and they have a New Mexico suborbital flight coming up soon. They have orbital missions coming out of the Cape on a Falcon 9. They have also orbital missions coming out of other launch sites as well. A moon mission. My mom and dogs are on that mission. Fourth quarter 2021. There'll be more about that, of course. And if you want information, Celestis.com. Remember, you can add your DNA to a little bit of the ashes along with your loved one. And you can ceremoniously or symbolically make the journey with them. The National Space Society sponsors us, so check them out. They do ISDC, a great conference every year, and other things like the Space Settlement event in Santa Monica. Their webpage has all sorts of white papers and other good information, space.nss.org. And then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us. They're a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. And you can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Join discussions, see regular updates, and participate in different kinds of interactive features. Excuse me. You can order your own full-color poster. It's two different sizes. It's inspiring. Check it all out and get your copy at thespaceplan.com. And welcome back to our second segment. We're talking to Michael Listener about lawfare or using war as a tool of law. Michael, I have another question to lead off. And again, listeners, we prefer phone calls like Marshall's, 1-866-687-7223. Paul.
And I prefer a phone call. And if you can, if you want to challenge me, please call and challenge me. I would just absolutely enjoy that.
Okay. Paul in upstate New York says, from your perspective, does putting human civilians like space tourists or space settlers in space complicate any of this?
I don't think from a lawfare perspective it does. And one of the things that I really be careful about since I've been really studying this is not to conflate everything that happens in international law with lawfare. In my briefing letter that David spoke about at the beginning, I have a section that's dedicated to lawfare, and I put things in there, events that I think are basically related to or could be used in the sense of lawfare. But I'm also when I put in that section, I also preface it by saying I'm very careful about making sure that I'm not looking at everything through a lawfare lens. I actually question and say, is this really lawfare? Putting human tourists in space or space flight participants, I'm not sure that really complicates things. I think it's more of a complication for international law and how they're treated in terms of in terms of current treaties like the Rescue Agreement and Liability Convention and things like that. So I don't think it really complicates it to that extent, unless you get a lot of pushback saying, well, a lot of states saying, we don't want this, we don't think it's the right thing. And if, the U.S. says, well, we really want to promote this, they may start, pushing in a sense that, using law and using influence in a sense that could be considered lawfare. But that was a good question, an interesting question. I had to think about that for a minute.
What if they engage in commerce, like resource utilization or mining? Does that change things?
Then it changes, and in fact, and we'll talk about this again a little bit more in detail, a little bit more in the show. But the whole idea of space resources, in my opinion, is actually the result of lawfare. This is a lawfare maneuver to change international law to reach this national interest. So yeah, that in the case of space resources, lawfare could definitely come into play.
That would be nations that could actually go do this versus nations that can't go do it?
Yeah, pretty much, you know, push back on it, saying, well, you know, you really can't do this, and saying, well, we want to do this, and basically justifying why we can do this according to law, or change in law, or facilitating a change in the law so that it is legal. And that, you know, that's been ongoing ever since. In fact, that law that they passed in 2015 has been, in my opinion, an instrumental piece of legislation for lawfare.
How do you see this panning out? What do you think would happen with a dispute of, say, lunar resource utilization?
Oh God, who knows? That's a little bit down the road, and you know, I'm into my wait and see approach on that one, because I really hate projecting too far out in the future and trying, saying, okay, this is what's going to look like. Sometimes I'm just like, you know, I got to sit down and clean up the mess once it happens. Sometimes in law, that's the way it is. You know, you just can't predict what's going to happen, especially in an area like this. Somebody's going to say, you know what, we'll just let the mess happen, and we'll clean it up when it does, and then fix it so it doesn't happen again.
So that's wait and see, and then fix it.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way I look at it. And that's what I tell people, because I haven't really given a lot of thought to it. I have so many other things going on. That's one of the things I haven't really devoted any time to my brain for.
I have another email. John is in Oklahoma City, mm-hmm. and he says, it seems like not all the spacefaring countries, even more or less the ones that believe in free access, are on the same page, because frequently the U.S. seems to have different positions on many of this than, say, the United Nations, which we're a member of. How does all of this play out in lawfare? Could we be...
Well, the idea is, you know, basically going back to the Bogota Declaration, when the states got together and ganged up on the equatorial countries to basically refute their claim to geosynchronous space, the U.S. took the opportunity to basically said, oh, by the way, we read the Outer Space Treaty to basically say that it's conducive. It basically permits all, you know, commercial activity and commercial development. So that was we took it. Basically, the idea is the government took the advantage at that point to take, in my opinion, a lawfare movement to make that assertion and put it out there. And it looks like, you know, for the most part, it stuck. So basically, they use that incident to basically take advantage to interpret the Outer Space Treaty to achieve a national interest, and that's, in this case, commercial activity.
Speaking of commercial activity, Barry in Houston sent in a note and said that the U.S. is evolving more and more to private sector only capabilities in space. So is lawfare going to look at corporate activity in space in the way you've been describing it between nation states?
And this gets back to the Outer Space Treaty. We still have, even though, you know, corporations will be doing these activities privately, the U.S. would still be responsible, being the, quote, launching state or the hosting nation. So, yeah, we'd definitely be responsible for any problems that arose. And if another nation got upset with us about it, they wouldn't go to the corporation. They'd come to us and complain about it. Based on what our interests were, we'd have to either, you know, slap the corporation on the wrist and, you know, say, don't, you know, you shouldn't do that, or basically go on the offensive and, you know, use lawfare, use diplomatic channels and diplomatic tools to say, no, we think this is consistent with this activity, even though you don't like it, we think it's consistent with international law the way it's written now.
And how does that get adjudicated? Because we don't practice or believe in the international court. So then,
No. I mean, the international court is, you know, I shake my head. It's just like, ugh. Well, you know, they could probably sue us. Technically, I think they could sue us in federal court. I mean, that, I know it's a bit, that's a big, I've been kind of, you know, pushing that a little bit, and people are like, I don't know about it. Actually, I'm thinking about writing a paper about it. I've been talking to a colleague of mine where we may be writing a paper about the federal courts. But, you know, I think the federal courts would have jurisdiction over it. The problem, you know, the whole problem with that is with another nation, you know, basically accept a ruling by, you know, by a U.S. federal court. I mean, in other words, would they abide by it? Because we can't necessarily enforce, we can't enforce it even after the judgment, if it's a foreign nation. But
well,
I think we could adjudicate it here.
Would a U.S. corporation, if they don't have any activities, say, in France, abide by a French court decision?
Well, it depends. It depends if the French had. I mean, if a case was going to happen, it would happen in the U.S. because the corporation would be a U.S. corporation. So that's where it would happen. It would happen in a U.S. court, not a French court. The question is, would the French abide by it? I don't even think. To be honest, I don't even think it would get to court. There would be a lot of diplomatic back and forth. You know, they go into the back room and they would discuss it and argue it out and say, and basically say, look, you know, we understand your concerns, but these are our interests and we're going to push them, and some sort of compromise would come to fore. I don't see France or anybody else coming to it. In fact, you know, I got a question about that last week from a reporter. They were talking about the Starlink issue with the satellites.
Right.
Getting a little bit off topic here. But this kind of plays into lawfare because, you know, they were saying, you know, there was this paper floating up. There's another paper floating out there saying, well, you know, we could take them to, you know, France or another country could take the U.S. to international court over this. And it's like, oh, you know, under the Outer Space Treaty. I'm like, well, you know, that's not going to work. For one thing, you know, how are you going to adjudicate it under the Outer Space Treaty, since the thing is so, you know, it is so fluid. You can make it say whatever you want to say and do backflips if you want. And number two, France is pretty much an ally, and we have similar interest, and I don't think something like that would even happen. You know, I don't think France would ever take the U.S. to court over something like that. Even if they had standing, so I don't know. So it's not so much an aside, but it's a little bit of lawfare snuck in there too.
Gina is in Tucson, and she says, I'm wondering if lawfare is a traditional law school class or topic.
It's not.
Is it showing
basically,
up now?
It's guerrilla warfare. It's basically guerrilla warfare, what we call asymmetric warfare. In other words, you're not fighting tradition. You're not fighting traditionally. This is something the military, you know, the U.S. military doesn't understand a lot. I have a colleague who, well, you know, you had Christopher Stone on last year, and he brought that up, you know, about lawfare. Chris and I talk a lot about that, but you know, lawfare is something that the military really doesn't understand because it isn't really general warfare. In fact, back in after 9/11, there was a Defense Department appropriations, and it went before Rumsfeld. And one of the things they wanted to include was actually, hey, let's do more of this lawfare stuff. And Rumsfeld didn't understand it, so he said, you know, we're not going to do it, without even looking at it, because he looked at it first thing and said, what's this? He didn't know what it was, didn't ask a lot of questions apparently, and just dismissed the idea altogether. But we'll get into that a little bit down the road too. But yeah, it's not a conventional way of approaching things. It's very asymmetric. And when you go back to what I said about Sun Tzu, defeat the enemy without fighting, Sun Tzu is very, it was all about asymmetric warfare, all about guerrilla warfare. He didn't have these straight on fights, that, you know, kind of basically dominates, modern military thought or modern Western military thought. They do not teach this in war colleges. Not yet, anyways. Not yet.
So even in the war colleges, they're not teaching any of this?
As far as I know, they don't teach it because this is such an obscure thing, and we're taught, you know, bullets, bombs, you know, soldiers, ships, missiles. These, you know, this is the way to fight a war. And I told this to another colleague, you know, and people, you know, well, like they, one guy questioned about, you know, why isn't, you know, the president's going to get us into, you know, the president's going to get us into a war. I said, no, he's not. He's got a lot. He's a smart. He understands. He has his whole suite of weapons in front of him. Not only has a kinetic military force, but he has cyber. He has economic warfare, which he's been waging, which is another, you know, basically a cousin of lawfare, and he's been doing some lawfare stuff too. He may not call it that, but he's been doing that. I think one thing was basically when the Iranians tried to launch a satellite a few months back last year. In fact, they're supposed to launch one today too. Actually, trying to launch one today. It took sanctions that were began by the Bush administration and extended them into the Iranian Space Agency. And I said, you know what? That's lawfare. That's using an executive action and expanding it, an executive action which is basically, in a sense, law, and expanding it to the Iranian Space Agency.
Why
I was impressed.
Why would the Iranian Space Agency follow that? Why would they care?
Well, the idea is having the sanction in place, and this gets to the whole thing about the rules. The rules are great, and in a Lockean world, everybody would follow the rules, or at least try and follow the rules. But in a Hobbesian world, the law of the jungle applies, and there are no rules. The whole idea is great. You can follow the rules, but I'm not going to, and I'm going to take advantage of that. There was even a Star Trek episode about that. Now that I think about that, and we're going to Star Trek, the original series here, folks. But there was an episode where this alien race beamed Spock, McCoy, and Kirk down onto a planet, and they revived people from the past, including Abraham Lincoln and a few others who were the good guys, and they brought against the bad guys. And that was, basically Colonel Green and a bunch of other very evil people. So basically the aliens wanted to understand the concept of good versus evil and whether good could triumph over evil. But a more fundamental area, it was basically the good guys follow the rules, the bad guys make the rules up as they go along, and they wanted to see who would win. And I'm thinking, that basically explains Hobbes, a Hobbesian viewpoint of the world.
Who won? I don't remember the episode.
Oh, of course the good guys won. the good guys, it was James T. Kirk. He wasn't going to lose.
What else do you want us to know in your PowerPoint?
Well, I'm looking at slide 21, and I just want to talk briefly about some of the tools of lawfare, because and this is kind of a short list because there's a lot of other things that could be used. Treaties, domestic law, believe it or not, domestic legislation can be used as lawfare, customary international law, and I'll put norms in there, and what we call soft law and non-binding measures. I'm going to go a little bit out of order here and talk about domestic law. There was an example I remember from back in 1986. There was a bombing of the Marine barracks. No, it was 82, I think it was. There was a bombing of Marine barracks in Lebanon, and the whole idea is Reagan basically did nothing. He was basically afraid of what the political ramifications would be of a hard military retaliatory strike. Well, a few years later, Congress actually passed a law. The question is, how are we going to get back to them? Now basically, intelligence agency has traced it back to Iranian funding of Hezbollah. So what what Congress did is, okay, we can't get them directly, but we're going to get them where it hurts, and we're going to stick the lawyers against them. We're going to get their money. We have a bunch of money we're holding in Iranian money we were holding in the accounts at that time. We're going to let the lawyers have a go at it. So basically, they passed a law that basically gave private individuals the right to sue the Iranian government for this. They actually made legislation for this, and the plaintiff's lawyers went crazy. They brought it to court because basically the Department of Justice and the military looked at this. We can't touch them because of politics, because of geopolitics. We'll let the attorneys get them in our courts. And of course, the Iranians had the opportunity to come to court and fight this. They were able to hire attorneys to fight this. But what happened is the victims of the families of these of the soldiers who were killed in the barracks bombing. They sued the government, and the Department of Justice fed them all kinds of information, in order to prove their case, and they won, and they started winning, and they were actually able to collect damages. The idea is they didn't get payback through a direct military strike, but they hit them where it hurts, in the pocketbook. And there's actually been a lot of it, and there's been, those types of actions aren't as prevalent today, but they're still going, in other respects, where private attorneys. And this gets back to my 2001 analogy, where I said, wait till the lawyers get a hold of them. That's where I thought, oh my God, this is so ironic, because I made it just kind of a small joke to break the tension in the air, but this actually happened. So that's an idea of domestic legislation. Space resource law in 2015, that get passed. Basically, that laid the foundation for private individuals to exploit space resources, and it was a launching pad for the U.S. to go out into the international arena and push this idea that this is what the Outer Space Based Treaty means. And it's been getting a lot of momentum. Well, we've talked to Mark Sundahl, who basically, came on your show and said, regardless what you think of it, this is going to happen. And he's right. This year is going to be a huge year for it in the U.N. But basically, the launching point for that was domestic law in the U.S., That basically used, quote, I talked about natural law at the beginning of this. It uses natural law to justify space resources, and Luxembourg's law, who also passed domestic law, and those laws are coming in. Actually, I think the UAE is going to announce their own law this year as well. So here you have basically these two laws, domestic, these actually it'll probably be three, that are coming in and shaping international law to allow allow the idea of space resources, lawfare.
Fascinating. So there'd be a lot on the table if somebody wanted to challenge this.
Well, like I said, this year is going to be a big year. Well, I talked in my last appearance back in December. You know, I talked about the Hague Working Group for Space Resources and what they came out with, and from the way I look at it, it's a challenge to the idea of space resources, promoted by the U.S. Another thing is the Moon Treaty, which is that treaty that's been sitting out there, and I talk about this a lot. Yeah, you got to watch out for the Moon Treaty. You got to watch out for the Moon Treaty because that thing isn't quite dead yet. That could challenge something. Again, that would be lawfare. The other nations of the world could use quote that international law to push back against our idea of what international law should be.
Simberg is back with us on Sunday. He has a lot to say about the Moon Treaty. Do you talk to him about this?
I met Rand a couple times last year, and we actually were at an event at the National Press Club, and he myself and actually Chris Newman was over here too. We were talking about that, and I looked at it, three of us were talking, and I said, whatever they're cooking over there at The Hague, the Space Resource Working Group, it is not what, it's really funky. And Rand looked at me and said, yeah, it's not space resources. And that came from Rand, who basically sees things too and calls it like sees it as well. So yeah, it is a different thing, but I'm getting back into this. This is lawfare. Now, actually, I had my own personal opportunity to promote lawfare because I was an observer for that working group and able to, put my comments in. And I did put my comments in. Some of them were pretty sharp as well.
Wow.
But yeah, little things like domestic legislation can be jumping off points for international lawfare.
If you talk to Chris Newman again, I'd still like to get him on the show. He never replied to my invitation.
Chris has been extremely busy. He's a full professor now, and he heads up there. So he just started a space law program at Northumbria University. Next time I talk to him, I'll let him know you're looking for him and you'd like to talk to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, you have another caller.
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
This is John of Fort Worth.
John. Okay, go for it.
I had to respond to this. It isn't really true that Reagan did nothing in response to the Marine bombing. He invaded Grenada.
Yeah, well...
No, politically. Politically, yeah. That was crucial because what it did... Now, that's a different... Mm-hmm. In other words, what he did by invading Grenada, remember they freed all the medical students and they all came back? Politically, it totally blew the press off the map because they didn't know what to do. I mean, they want to be mad at him for invading Grenada. Do they want to be mad at him for doing nothing militarily in Lebanon? It just sort of, it was an amazing political move, I think.
That's political warfare, and actually lawfare and political warfare, they're kind of joined at the hip sometimes. But you're talking about pure political warfare. What I'm talking about, the real revenge, was Congress passing it, let the private families go after it, and the DOJ and everybody else kind of just fed the plaintiffs' attorneys all this information that they needed in order to get a good verdict out of it, and they hit them right in the pocketbook. And it's just like, you know what? It is. It basically, in the long run, it serves a national interest.
But the families of 9/11 want to go after Saudi Arabia, and they're being blocked for that. Correct?
Well, they are because Saudi Arabia is an ally, right? Is an ally in the Middle East, and
so they're getting screwed because they're an ally, and whereas Iran. They help give Iran crap because they're obviously not an ally.
Well, and again, that's politics, and I defer it to the people who basically have the information to make those decisions. I don't have an opinion on that, but I think what you said is probably accurate.
John, what else?
Well, that was just it. I couldn't resist making that comment.
No, that's fine. I mean, that's good. But you brought up a very good point because politics and lawfare, they're kind of joined at the hip. Well, actually, and it goes back to my definition. The idea of lawfare is to use the law to achieve a national interest or a political goal. Plain and simple.
I did do sometimes wonder, though, if things like what we're doing with Iran, if this won't come back to bite us with somebody else doing this to us.
Well, that's the thing. I told somebody one time. I said, you know what? With space, you got to be careful what you do because somebody else might figure, oh, this is a good idea. They did it, so it must be all right to do it. So you got to be careful what you do because somebody's probably going to copy you. I think you know we're kind of seeing. There's an inspector satellite right now, kind of shadowing a remote sensing satellite, one a KH-11, I believe. It's a Russian bird, and they're getting kind of nervous. They're kind of wondering, okay, what's going on here? Well, we can get all excited about it, but actually, you know, the U.S. has been, you know, playing around with that same idea and doing that for quite a long time. And in fact, back in 2007, they actually released in Space Flight Now, there was actually an article about these two satellites called MITEX that were playing around in the geosynchronous belt. They were going to use maneuver them over to inspect a missile warning bird that this went dead for no reason to try and figure out what happened to it. And I think, and I almost spilled my coffee. I could not believe they were revealing that capability publicly. But yeah, I mean, basically, we've kind of set up the idea that okay, it's okay to do this. I'm not quite saying it's a norm or an acceptable practice, but I'm just saying we've done it, so everybody else is saying okay, maybe we can do it too.
Yeah, very very interesting presentation. I enjoyed it.
Well, it's got a little bit more to go. I mean, I got into this thinking, you know, this is extremely esoteric. I mean, you've got to come at it with a lawyer's mind. But I really, and this is why I work, you know, so hard on this presentation to really just, you know, boil it down to the essence to try and, you know, help the audience understand, you know, what this is, that this is really out there, and things are pretty much, you know, it can get really complicated really quick.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't know if anybody else has time to call in, but I'll let them have a chance.
And thank you very much.
Okay.
Listeners, you can call us. Fort Worth John is off the telephone. It is 1-866-687-7223. Do you think any of this, well, you've kind of already answered it, but do you think any of this is sort of underlying our policy for space, like Bridenstine, for example, or is this in the back of their minds as they assert commercial space or some of the things that they want to do in space, like resource mining?
Well,
do they contemplate
they leave the real heavy hitting to the State Department as far as, you know, and how to shape the law and stuff like that. NASA basically has, you know, they have their legal department. They say, okay, is this legal? And of course, you know, the Commerce Department and the FAA are involved or have to look at this too because, you know, that basically the FAA is the one that approves it. And of course, NOAA has to approve remote sensing licenses. Of course, the FCC has to approve, spectrum. So they got to look at the international law as well. But they really don't play the lawfare game as much as this is something that's more State Department-ish and type, you know, maybe the intel agency is a little bit. It's kind of out of the point. It's basically on the point of the stick, as opposed to being, you know, the one holding the stick.
So I know you've talked to some of the lawyers with the State Department and all of this. Are they aware of lawfare? Do they talk to you about it?
I don't know. I never really had anybody from the State Department talk to me about lawfare. I'd love to talk to him about it sometime.
Like you put me in touch with this one guy who did agree to come on the show, and then he wrote back
and said he was too busy.
Yeah, I
mean, well, you know, he and I have had our disagreements over a few things, and let's just say we don't meet eye to eye on a lot of things, and I haven't talked to him in a while. But no, I mean, like I said, this is very esoteric. I mean, because, you know, from a lot of people's perspective, you know, well, it depends on how, like I said, depends on how you view the law. Some people view the law as, you know, we're going to create rules of law. We're going to make global order. Okay, a lot of people think about global order, and that's a Lockean idea, going back to John Locke. I look at it, and actually, there was a former CIA director basically came out and said, the world is Hobbes. It's Hobbesian. It isn't Lockean. It's Hobbesian. It's law of the jungle. It isn't global order. It's basically there are no rules apply. It's, you know, you do what you can to get the result. So I'm kind of, you know, I come from the perspective of it isn't law, it isn't always about order, but law is, also an adversarial aspect. So I guess you could say I'm kind of split in the middle. It isn't pure, the world isn't pure Lockean. In other words, it isn't pure rule of law, and it isn't pure Hobbesian, which is law of the jungle. It's really kind of a mix of both. It's kind of, they're both kind of jumbled together because we, you know, nations, again, bottom line, this is about nations preserving and pursuing their own interests. You know, I see things, well, you know, you see a lot of things about cooperation and stuff like that. That's lawfare. You know, that's basically putting out the, you know, putting the idea that, you know, you want cooperation, but at the same time, you got to make sure your interests are served. And if it serves your interest to talk about cooperation and not do it, so be it. That, you know, as long as it gets the result you want. I mean, and it all goes back to, what are the tools of lawfare? And I kind of, like I said, I listed a few of them here. I talked about customary Hello?
Yeah, what was that? You're being censored?
I'm not sure. But bottom, I know what it is. I think somebody was trying to come in on this line. Okay. Let's talk about customary international law. I won't get into the definition, but it's basically law that's basically created by actions. Well, we look at the free access of outer space that we talked about earlier, you know, and with Sputnik and such. That was created through custom. But there's things that have been really popping up as of late that are called what we call norms. And norms are kind of funny in that basically the idea is that a norm is basically a standard, what we call a standard behavior that, you know, is expected, you know, that everybody would expect everybody to abide by. And the problem with norms is you can basically, they said, well, they're not, norms are supposed to be non-binding, but really they're supposed to be binding. So the idea is you propose a norm saying this is the norm, and then in the long term you say, you try and get that established, and you try and get that to gain traction and actually stick. And once you get it stick, you can assert and say, oh, This isn't just a norm. This is actually binding customary international law because other nations have decided they're going to be legally bound by it. I hear a lot about norms lately, and I'm very careful about, you know, what's a norm and kind of push back on things that people say are norms because that's really the weapon of choice. That's the lawfare weapon of choice lately for people like the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation and even non-government organizations who are out promoting what we call, quote, space security and sustainability. They like to propose norms. I guess, you know, and so basically customary international law and norms are important. Soft law, non-binding measures. I used to be very, very infamous for the code of conduct. I almost got stuck into a rut of being the code of conduct guy. The Europeans proposed one that morphed into the international code of conduct. It was supposed to be non-binding, but the big argument was, bottom line is, it was soft law that could have become hard international binding law if it had really gained any traction. And examples of that are the code of conduct, transparency and confidence building measures, which are going on in the group government experts right now, rules being collated by academia. There are two separate rule books for military activity in outer space being collated. The Milimos, I think one by the McGill University and the other by the University of Nebraska and the University of Adelaide. They're co-venturing a rules manual as well. And the draft's supposed to come out this year. They worry me because basically they're proposing these what hard and fast rules are, and unfortunately I wasn't asked to join in it. Regrettably, I probably would have had a few words to say about them, which is probably why I wasn't asked to join. But my concern is, you know, these are great ideas to put out there, but do you really want these to be hard and fast rules? And hearing some of the comments by some of the participants, you know, that basically, you know, they're basically alluding to the fact this is more to bind the U.S. than it is to, keep outer space, quote, you know, peaceful. So it really kind of worries me a little bit. Back in 2018, I was at the National Press Club, and a friend and colleague of mine who is active in one of these manuals, led basically a panel discussion on it. And, you know, there were four or five panelists there, and they were up and down, extolling these rules, yada, yada, yada. And it was the end of the day, and I was sitting there, and I said, you know what, I'm just going to be nice. I'm not going to give him a hard time with this, you know, because he's a friend and a colleague, and I really respect him. But I just got kind of, you know, I was tired. I'd been up for 17 hours. And finally, I said, you know what, and my friend said, one more question. So I raised my hand. And he said, "Hey, Mike, what do you think?" And I said, "What if they don't follow the rules?" but my friend just threw up his hands and shook his head, and everybody else on the panel just didn't have a response. And I got into a small toss up with one individual, but over it. But I went up afterwards to my friend to apologize. He said, No, that was great. He says, You threw a monkey wrench into it. And I said, well, there you go. And basically I said, the world is Hobbes. And I basically put a Hobbesian argument to it. So rules are great, but the problem is what happens if people don't follow the rules? And you decide we're going to follow the rules, but somebody else doesn't, but they still expect you to. And it goes back to my Star Trek issue, my Star Trek episode. So guidelines for sustainability, those were approved last year. I think those are another area where law could be used as areas of lawfare. Again, through customary international law, the idea of treaties are passé, although you have a few things like PEROS, what we call PEROS, and the PPWT, which the PRC and the Russian Federation have been promoting big time. And this is, again, a big lawfare exercise and soft power exercise in the UN. I want to talk briefly about lawfare actors and who's actually doing this and who's out there actually promoting this. Obviously, number one, states, individual states. They basically go out, they promote and use lawfare either state to state through diplomatic channels, media, and they use international organization as well. International organizations, they go in and promote lawfare. The big thing was with PRC. They go into the UN and do this. You know, we believe in the peaceful uses of outer space. And don't mention, oh, by the way, we're building this huge, you know, ASAT arsenal on the side here. But we still want peace in outer space and non-aggression in outer space. And it basically leveraged treaties and such and soft power within and use it in lawfare to promote their agendas and to, you know, basically to the detriment of their geopolitical adversaries, who happens to be us most of the time, unfortunately. So, obviously state actors are the big ones. I talked earlier about academia, and they basically engage in lawfare through scholarly articles, formal publications that are peer-reviewed. They basically put their ideas out there and, you know, basically assert these and see if they can gain traction as customary international law or be adopted by other, you know, international state actors as binding international law. They promote changes to international law through the promotion of formal rules, like I talked about just a few minutes ago, and the norms that I talked about. And some examples, space resources, we talked about that. Another big one that's been coming up is the limitation of outer space in the atmosphere, where scholars have been very active in saying, well, maybe we really should have a fixed point where the atmosphere ends and space begins. Nationalization of outer space, the PRC, where their scholars are basically trying to make the case for nationalizing outer space above their territory. And formal rules for military activity in outer space that we just talked about. Those are some of the areas that academia is actually very active in lawfare. And just going back to space resources really briefly, academia was very helpful in laying the legal foundation through articles. And I know a few people who actually wrote some of the articles. They actually put the idea out that and basically the U.S. government basically was used to build upon and actually make the case for the international community to get where we are right now. Non-governmental organizations or NGOs. My favorite, NGOs are kind of basically the silent warriors in lawfare. They basically interact with international institutions and other governments, and they promote formal rules, treaties, and they use narrative to basically support suggest these, you know, the creation of norms or that certain norms exist. And I told you norms are one of those things where people will say it exists and they try to get people to believe it. It's like, it's basically saying, you know, there's a unicorn in front of you. There's a unicorn in front of you. No, there isn't. Well, if you pester somebody long enough and you say it often enough and get people sick, you might get them to admit there is a unicorn standing in front of them just to make them go away. But if you give them that foothold, they're going to say, well, you told me, you said there's a unicorn in front of you. And you just said, yeah, and then you're kind of stuck. So norms are kind of slippery like that. An example of that is earlier this year after the Indian ASAT test, a couple NGOs came out and were saying that the Indians violated, quote, the norm of non-destructive ASAT testing. And I was like, wait a minute, where did this come from? There's no such thing. Where did this idea of non-destructive ASAT testing come from? And it's just like, it doesn't exist. It's just something that was basically conjured out there and basically to further, to actually try and get it, basically saying, oh, because, you know, I have a reputation or because I belong to this NGO or this organization, because I'm saying it, it must be true to see if people get to accept it. So I push back against that a little bit. No, I push back against the law. Let's put it that way. Another example of a norm, when the X-37 returned late last year, the Air Force announced that it released a couple CubeSats during the mission. Well, everybody went furiously to the registered to SpaceTrack to see, you know, whether they were registered or not, and they weren't. And one individual came out on Twitter and said, oh, my God, this is a violation of the U.S. The U.S. violated the liability convention by not registering this. And another, you know, and somebody else jumped in and said, oh, this is going to create a norm for the PRC and the Russians. I jumped in very aggressively and fought back against that. Basically, no treaty violation, no norm. And it was very disturbing how people were buying into this. And I was like, no.
So why isn't it a norm now?
It isn't a norm. Well, I'm just saying, basically, it's what isn't a norm?
Launching the CubeSats without registration.
Well, basically the argument is there's nothing in the treaty that says when you have to register them.
Okay.
So eventually, you know, they may have been eventually registered, but because they weren't registered at that point, everybody was saying it was a treaty violation. And my point was, you know what, it isn't a treaty violation until another state comes back and complains about it. And then it's a treaty violation. But this is an example of using even social media for lawfare purposes to create the idea or the perception of norms. So, yeah, NGOs are extremely prolific in this area, and really they're going to be even more so. I guess I'm going to close this out a little bit by coming to this thing, and I'm looking at slide 30. Does lawfare really exist? I get a lot of people who come back and say, oh, you're being paranoid. Oh, you're being, you know, you're being fear-mongering. This doesn't really exist. I wrote an article for the Space Review about this back in September 2018, and I even had one guy put in a comment, you know, you have no idea what space law is. You should talk to such and such who really knows what space law is. And I just thought, says, I know this guy. This guy and I talk often. He's a colleague, so I really know what space law is. But the idea is people don't think this really exists. It does. This is actually incorporated in some states actually use this as part of their doctrine and their strategy. And I think a prime example is the PRC, where they adopted a warfare concept for the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, known as the Three Warfares. And I have it out there on the slide. But basically, one of the three prongs to the Three Warfares is legal warfare, which basically employs domestic law and international law to further the PRC's interests by asserting the legal high ground. Legal warfare can also restrict the geopolitical rivals' freedom to operate both military and geopolitically in certain domains and shape operational domains. They can protect Chinese military actions from political fallout through the building of international support and leverage. So the PRC has basically recognized that legal, along with political and psychological, these three warfares are effective tools in their arsenal, as well as missiles, planes, guns, navies, and troops. This is part of their arsenal, and they've actually incorporated it. We haven't gotten to that point yet, which is really interesting that, you know, this week that they announced that they're going to replace the National Security Space Strategy, the NSSI, and I think that was last done in 2011. And my point, you know, I made a point on LinkedIn. One of the gentlemen who's actually doing this, he's one of my connections on LinkedIn. I said, "Hey, Steve, one word: lawfare. This is a golden opportunity for the U.S., for the military, for the Defense Department to put, to actually recognize lawfare as an official, as an actual tool, as an actual domain, and incorporate it in, and develop it, and develop their own lawfare strategy, or at least recognize it and say, we've got to develop our own coordinated strategy. Basically, I've been, you know, promoting this, saying, look, the U.S. has most lawyers per capita than any other state, any other nation in the world. Let's use them. Let's use them. And this is a perfect way to do it. But a lot of that's through education of what lawfare really is. And, like I said, I think this new space strategy, if you're writing a clean sheet strategy, this is a good opportunity to stick lawfare in there as a tool for, furthering, you know, furthering the legal domain for outer space, especially for the military.
Are they going to do that? Do you know?
I have no idea. I have no idea. But you know, this is an opportunity to do it. And if any administration will do it, this administration will do it because they're very open minded about, you know, different means of doing it. But I mean, it's one of these things that exists. Other nations use it. The Russians and the Soviets have used it very effectively during the Cold War and presently. Yeah, I think it's one of these things that we should really look at and start promoting more. Like I said, I think we've been doing it but not realizing what we've been doing.
So they're creating a new national space policy for the U.S., or did you say something else?
National Security Space Strategy, the NSSI, National Security Space Strategy. Yeah, it was first, the current one was made in 2011, and they're going to replace it with a new one. So, not a new national space policy, but a new national space strategy.
When is the new one supposed to be replaced? When is it?
They're working on it right now. They're working on it right now. But like I said, this is an opportunity. Since this is going to be the domain of the Defense Department, they have an opportunity to actually include lawfare as part of the strategy. It may not be in the unclassified version, but it's something they could definitely stick into the class non-public version.
Of course, we'll never know if it's in the classified version.
We'll never know. But it's an opportunity, and understand that if you have a coordinated lawfare effort, it could be extremely effective, and it could save lives. It could be, you know, and politically, it could save a lot of politically compromising positions, and it could be extremely effective. I mean, it's been very much usually heavily affected, you know, in all domains by, you know, not just space, not just the oceans, but in all domains. So it's a very effective strategy, and it's something we should really look at. Like I said, we have the most lawyers in the world. Let's put them to work.
Perry is in Los Angeles. He's probably the closing comment or question of the day. And he said, is there a buzzword or is there a legal term or a word that might be used that means lawfare without saying lawfare?
No. Lawfare is the buzzword. Lawfare is the buzzword to basically say we're using legal means instead of hard military power to further our national interests or meet a political goal. That's my definition of lawfare, and really my definition of lawfare changes a lot, and it changes. In fact, I think I mentioned when I was doing these slides, I actually took my definition of lawfare that I've been going with the past 4 months, and I actually sat down and I did two or three different variations for it before I came up with what I have on the slides here for my definition. So it's always changing as I think about this more, it's. You know, it's one of those things. It's one of those things. It isn't totally set in concrete. It's one of those things that's fluid and is flexible, that can be changed to meet changes in the geopolitical environment.
Michael, before we leave, tell us about the Pressies.
The Pressie, my quarterly briefing letter. I do it. I have four quarterly issues a year, and then I have special issues in between. In fact, I'm as soon as probably this week, I'm going to be working on another special issue on the Starlink controversy and the FCC. There's been a lot of hyperbole about, you know, the FCC being taken to court. Basically, the idea is on this special issue, I'm going to give my 2 cents worth. Hopefully have it out by next week sometime after I work through it. But special issues, they get written if something important comes up in between a quarterly issue and I want to talk about it. But like I said, four quarterly issues. They usually come out at the end of March, June, September, and December. individual subscription, $199 a year. I take PayPal. If you're a government employee or retired government or military, I'll give you a discount. If you go to my site and look at the rates, they are there, and you can subscribe right there by PayPal. It comes in via, I send it via PDF via email. I don't have an electronic thing, so there's no paywall, but you get it right in your email box. And in a PDF, that's my preferred way of doing it right now. And my current subscribers seem to like it that way. I've had a lot of good feedback about it. I have some very interesting subscribers, and I've fortunately been, you know, it's been getting a bit onerous, especially with all the litigation that's been going on here domestically. But I have a young attorney who from Texas who helps me on the litigation section. His name is Joshua Smith. Good guy, very smart, and very, 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 how can you say, he really likes to, you know, the fact that he's able to participate and help me work with, you know, help me in the litigation section, and he is a huge help. But I cover a lot of things, and, you know, my quarterly issues generally run from up to, I think the largest one was 70 pages one time. Those are with spacing and a 14 type font size. But that's my briefing letter, and I basically call it like I see it, and I cover everything from domestic law to foreign policy and legislation, to national security issues, to litigation and geopolitics, and I even do lawfare. Lawfare I added a few years back in 2018. So that, you know, basically go to my site, go to the Pressy tab, and you can subscribe there. If you want a free issue, click the free issue thing, and I'll gladly send you a free issue to look at.
Okay. Anything we've left out? Anything we should have talked about? Anything we've omitted that you think we should cover?
I think we covered it. The slides are still there. If you want, you can still leave the slides up for people to look at. The information
okay.
is there. I just want people to know this is. Not even brushing the surface. It is just going over the surface of what this topic is like. I mean, it's extremely. It's very esoteric. It's complicated, and it can be mind bending sometimes. But I just wanted people. You know, I mentioned it. You asked me about it. I wanted people to know this does exist. It does apply to outer space. It's applied in the past, the present, and it's going to apply in the future. And this is something people should be aware of.
Absolutely. We'll be looking for it. I'll bet we will recognize it in things that come out in the news and in policies and in behavior of states in the coming year.
Like I said, you know, I'm very careful not to jump to a conclusion and say something is lawfare, you know, automatically, because not everything that happens in international arena is necessarily lawfare. It can become lawfare, but doesn't mean it at present is lawfare. So, you know, that's my challenge when I write my quarterly issues for the Pressy. Is something, you know, yes, this is an international arena, but is this lawfare? And sometimes maybe, well, it isn't yet, so I won't call it that, but I always reserve the right to go back and say, yeah, well, now it is. So it's like I said, extremely esoteric. This is pretty high level stuff. But I hope I was able to at least, you know, inform people and educate people about this to at least a small degree today.
Do we get continuing education credits from you?
I'm not affiliated with any bar. There's no continuing legal education for lawyers. No credits for any professions. This is just for your informational purposes. My disclaimer is actually on slide two.
Yeah, I saw that, but we skipped over that. Michael, we thank you. We look forward to talking to you down the road during 2020. So when interesting things happen, let us know, and we'll also be reaching out to you. For those of you who called and emailed us today, thank you very much for participating. Remember, Zubrin is back on Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. California time. Thanks to Michael for a great job, for a really excellent PowerPoint and a discussion. We truly appreciate it. Post your comments on the blog for those of you that will be hearing this on archives. Let us know your thoughts and your questions, and you can challenge Michael on the blog too. So he's always up for a good challenge. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Do keep it safe. Have a good week coming up. And above all, keep looking up, especially at the moon late tonight or early this morning on the East Coast, because it is a super snow moon. So if you want to know what that means, check it out. But I saw it last night, and it was incredible over my head last night. It'll be 11:33 p.m. my time in California tonight. Hope my skies are clear, so adjust it to your time locally. And post that comment on the blog, too. Everybody have a great week coming up. And once again, thanks to Michael Listener for a terrific job in working with us here on the Space Show. Goodbye from all.